and I'd just blow the whole thing off, stay in bed. But I didn't. Mostly out of concern for job security. So my other option today is to just keep talking until everybody's out, and you can get caught up on your sleep. So hopefully that's not what happens, but we'll see. But you know, the thing is we tend to put rest over and against action. So that, you know, my attempt at humor is, if I stay in bed, then I'm resting. If I come to church in the morning, then I'm acting. And so, you know, there's rest and there's action, that kind of a thing. The story we're looking at this morning discloses something totally different. And that is that rest is rather the core of our action, or almost at the center of our action. There's a way that we can live in the world in which our acting comes out of a place of rest. Now, that's counterintuitive for us. And some of that is maybe because we have watched too many action movies. You know, there's a kind of general, you know, I like a good action movie as much as the next person, but there's a kind of general flow to an action movie. And it's kind of like this. There's a setting in which there's something chaotic, oppressive. There's some menace at the edge of society that's threatening to undo us. And our very well-being is called into question, and we're vulnerable. And the generic masses usually have no idea the threat that they face, right? But there's one person, usually a man. There's one man, but you know, Angelina Jolie's gotten a few feminine roles. But you know, the format still works the same, whether it's a heroine or a hero. And so there's one man whose special, or woman, whose special set of skills is such that they are the only thing that stands between utter total chaos and evil ruling the day and, you know, just kind of life as usual and bliss and whatever. And so there's a moment midway through where the hero gets injured or captured or something like that, and so now they bear the burdens of their heroic task in their body, and they, you know, slug it out all the way to the very end. And the final scene of the movie is the hero. You know, there's the smoking building behind them, and, you know, Die Hard kind of thing. And the hero's in an ambulance, right? Or something like that. I mean, there's a wound that they've taken on their flesh, and they're in the ambulance, and even in the ambulance, they are never laying down. Watch next time. They're never laying down. They're always propped up, sitting up in their seat. Why? Because the hero is not like you and me. The hero never grows tired or weary. The hero can overcome any obstacle thrown in his or her way. The hero, if the hero quits working, we all die. Do you understand that? We depend on the hero being tireless. Evil can only be held at bay unless the hero keeps at the task. So, you know, like the Batman series, the newest one, The Dark Knight. Christopher Nolan is this burdened figure all the way through. Because if he needs to go away from Gotham City, but if he does, we know what's going to happen. Evil will rule. So he must keep on the burden of saving Gotham City. Right? I'm not off on this. Right? That's our action hero. Now here's the thing, is we idolize that, and we see that in a deep sort of way as also what makes kind of heroic Christian faith possible. And we look at the life of Jesus, and Jesus for us becomes action hero part two, or maybe the original action hero. So open up with me to Matthew chapter 8. We're going to talk about Jesus, the action hero. We're just going to walk all the way through chapter 8 to this passage that was read earlier, where Jesus is caught in the storm with the disciples. The chapter 8 begins with Jesus coming down from the mountain, and the mountain he's on is the mountain where he gave the Sermon on the Mount. You know, the greatest sermon recorded in the Bible. And what is remarkable about the sermon for those that were there is that Jesus taught as one with authority. Jesus was this authoritative teacher, held the masses captive with his teaching for hours and hours and hours. And he now comes down off the mountain after teaching about the nearness of the kingdom of God, the presence of God on earth. And he is immediately struck, immediately encountered by the chaos, by the forces that threaten to undo us, by our human sin and our alienation and our sense of what's wrong in the world and our sense of what needs to be made right. You see, as he's coming down off the mountain, a man with leprosy comes to him. And leprosy was this awful skin disease that separated people from community. They were cast out of the community. So it wasn't just that you had a bad disease, but it was that you couldn't participate in life with anybody else. And this leper, this excluded, this alienated man, comes to Jesus and says, "Jesus, if you are willing, heal me." And Jesus says, "I am willing." And he reaches out and he touches the leper, and the leper is made clean. And then in verse 5, he's entering the city of Capernaum, and a Roman centurion comes to him. He's not a Jew. He's actually the enemy for the Jews. And he comes to Jesus and he says, "Teacher, I have a servant who is ill and who is paralyzed. Would you please heal him?" And so Jesus says, "Yes, I'll come to your house and heal him." And the centurion says, "No, I'm not worthy to have such an honored guest in my home. But listen, I command soldiers. And I know how this works. When I am there, the soldiers listen to me. But when I am away, I have authority. And the soldiers listen to me then too. Aren't you like that? Don't you have authority over this sickness that you don't have to come into my home?" And Jesus turns. And in the middle of this conversation with the centurion, where he's going to heal the centurion's servant, he turns to his disciples and he uses that as a teaching moment. He says, "Friends, I have not encountered this kind of faith anywhere in all of Israel." And he uses it to teach about the kingdom of God. And the kingdom of God is not something that is only available for those in religious insiders, but for anybody who responds in faith. And so Jesus says, "Yes, actually, that is how it works. I can heal. I have authority over the sickness here that I can heal from here." And so it says at that very moment, the centurion's servant is healed. Then Jesus gets to the house where he's going to stay that night, Peter's house, and his mother-in-law is there, and his mother-in-law is sick with a fever. And friends, in the ancient world, a fever could have been a sign of the end. I mean, this is serious. This isn't just, "Oh, give her a Tylenol." And Jesus touches her, and he heals her. And news spreads. And the rest of the night, people are bringing the wounded, the lonely, the oppressed, the sick, to Jesus. And he spends the night touching and healing. And so Matthew tells us in verse 17, "He took up our infirmities and carried our diseases." That's a quote from the prophet Isaiah, and it's a passage that talks about the suffering servant in the prophet Isaiah. The servant who takes upon himself all of the people's troubles and bears their burdens so that they might live. And it's saying Jesus is doing that. Jesus is taking on the burdens and the chaos and the dysfunction and the forces of evil that threaten to undo us. Jesus is taking on all of that. He's carrying our diseases. He's taking up our infirmities. And there's a sense in which this whole thing depends upon Jesus not growing tired, doesn't it? This whole thing depends upon Jesus, that he keeps pressing on, that he keeps healing those that come to him. Because if he stops, we're all in trouble. We don't know who else can heal our sicknesses. We need Jesus to be an action figure. And there's some heroic folks among the crowds that see Jesus. Now this is the next day, and Jesus sees the crowds, and he gets into a boat, and he tells them he wants to go to the other side. And so then in verse 18, you have the crowds coming to Jesus saying, "Jesus, we will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus says, "Hold on. Foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." Another person says, "Jesus, I'm going to follow you, but I've got to go take care of some business at home. I have to bury my father." And Jesus says, "Let the dead bury their own dead." Now, when we see Jesus as an action figure, this looks an awful lot like Jesus saying, hey, folks, if you want to follow me, realize there's a high cost. There's a lot expected of you. And you're going to have to leave the comforts of home and get really uncomfortable if you're going to follow me. This is not for the faint of heart, Jesus is saying. It's like Jesus is saying, man up. Sorry about the gender-specific term. There isn't really a feminine compliment, yeah. Cowboy up. Yeah, that's maybe what they say in Prince George, huh?
No, Taylor.
Oh, Taylor, sorry. They want to join in this conquest with Jesus, this adventure with Jesus, to push back the things that threaten us, to make us less vulnerable to the forces that threaten to undo us. Now, some of them turn away at this moment, but there are some that get in the boat with Jesus. No doubt with images and visions of conquest and triumph and excitement on the road. Tireless effort with Jesus. And so they get in the boat and they push off, and now it's nightfall, and they settle in for the night. And out of nowhere, a storm whips up. Now, for the Hebrews, the sea was a sign or a symbol of the forces of chaos and evil that threaten us. The sea was, for the Hebrews, always a picture of how vulnerable we are in the world. That the creation can't always be trusted. That there's forces in the world that threaten us at any and every moment. Now, we think of the sea, and we think vacation, and holiday, and sun tanning. We go on cruises, and that would have been chaos. That would have been totally unthinkable in the ancient world. You don't get on a boat and cross the ocean unless you have to. Why? Because you're in this little dinghy, and like when something sweeps up, there's no place to go. The sea was a symbol of how vulnerable we are. The sea was always on the verge of chaos. Anything could happen when you're out there. And so the disciples are out in this boat at night, and the forces of chaos conspire against them, and they're threatened, and they're vulnerable. Now, they're fishermen, so they have experience with this, but they recognize very quickly they're in over their head. And no doubt they're thinking, this is life on the road with Jesus. This is the adventure he's calling us to. This is the risk and the sacrifice. And we probably all see ourselves in this at some point as well. Isn't this the picture of discipleship? Isn't this the picture of following Jesus? We're in the boat with him, and whatever forces at work in the world that are against what is good, whatever threatens to harm our neighbor, whatever conflict zones or injustices that exist, aren't we here so that we can fight against them? So that we can join in with the good work that Jesus is doing? I mean, we can't open up the paper and not read about hundreds of things happening just within our narrow realm of influence that are wrong, that are evil, that are harmful. We can start with homelessness in Burnaby and talk all day. We can talk about human trafficking. We could talk about the various war zones that keep popping up over things that we all use, like gas, oil. We could talk about the fact that we're almost all probably wearing clothes that were made for less than $1 a day. There's more wrong in the world than we know where to start. And part of life with Jesus is we join in because we want to do good. We want to create some realm of change, something positive. And so we're on this boat in the middle of the storm, and we're fighting for what is right, and we're fighting for what is good. And we better not grow tired or weary. We better not slow down, because if we do, who's going to pick up where we left off? Right? This is why we signed up for this. the middle of the storm. As the disciples are realizing that they are now fully in over their heads. They realize that this storm is greater than them. And we can identify with that too. I mean, as soon as I start talking about things that I know are wrong around me, I don't know where to start. And I know I'm not big enough to complete it. There's more wrong than we know what to do. No matter how much striving, no matter how much strategizing, no matter how smart we are, I'm not sure always how much we can accomplish. And so the disciples are in the boat, and the waves threaten to undo them. And they realize they are at their end. And they look around, and somebody's missing. And they're probably thinking that that person got thrown overboard, or they're hiding in the corner weeping. But then they realize the one who's missing is Jesus. And they look and they see, and while the boat's being pitched all over the place, he's sound asleep on the floor. And certainly we've all felt that. Here we think we're doing what God has called us to. We think we've signed up for the thing, this good work. And we know if we rest or if we slow down, if we step aside, that the good things that God is doing just might not continue. We can't afford, the world can't afford for us to slow down. And then we look around, Jesus, right? Jesus, where are you? We felt that. God, where are you? Jesus, where are you? And so they shake him and they say, Jesus, don't you care? Don't you care that we're going to die? And I don't know what they want, but I'm guessing they want Jesus to get up and start ordering them around. Okay, you, man the sail, and you, you know, sort of like one of those Russell Crowe movies. But Jesus doesn't. He stands up. And Matthew uses a very specific word. He says, and he rebukes. Looking here in verse 26, he got up and he rebuked the winds and the waves. And it was completely calm. See, the word rebuke that's used there is the same word that is used in other places in the New Testament when Jesus, he heals somebody, but he doesn't heal them. He rebukes the fever. And when he casts out demons, sometimes it says casts out, but sometimes it says, in Greek, it says he rebuked the demons. It's the same word that's used in the Greek translation of Psalm 106 that's talking, singing praises about the dividing of the Red Sea. And it says that God rebuked the Red Sea, and where there was waves, there was then dry land, and so his people could walk across. You see, the word rebuke is a word of authority. Now, there's times when I rebuke my children. You know, like, stop hitting your sister. Or, stop talking to each other and go to sleep. You know, very direct, very simple rebukes. Now, sometimes my children say, or they don't say, I say, stop! And they stop. But there's a lot of times that I say, stop talking to your sister, and so they just talk quieter. Or I say, stop hitting your sister, and they just hit when I'm not looking. You see, the thing about a rebuke is it's an exercise of authority. But unless the one you're rebuking recognizes your authority, you're just blowing hot air. Unfortunately, my kids don't always recognize my authority. We'll talk about parenting classes later. But Jesus, at this moment, rebukes the wind and the waves. It's an expression of authority. And they go silent. They go calm. He puts the forces of chaos, the things that threaten to undo us, the evil, the alienation, all that, you know, the symbol of all that is wrong in the world, he rebukes it and it goes quiet. He exercises authority. And you see, it's exactly at this moment The disciples now look at Jesus and they reconsider everything that they've just witnessed. They say, who is this? That even the winds and the waves obey him. Who is this that has such authority? Who is this that can rebuke the weather and it listens? It's so easy to look back and to see Jesus' action, his healing, his teaching, his caring, his compassion, as a tireless conquest of what's wrong with the world. It's so easy to see all that and see action hero and see activism. But it's at this moment the disciples catch a glimpse of something totally different. It's not Jesus' epic struggle against all that's wrong in the world. That's not what's at stake in the healings and in the teaching and in the calming of the sea. It's the fact that Jesus trusts and entrusts himself to the God who made all of this in the first place. You see, Jesus' whole life was one that was lived in light of one simple idea, one simple truth. And that is that the kingdom of God is near. By kingdom of God, we mean the place of God's reign, the place of God's activity. And it's not just that the kingdom of God is near, but it's that the kingdom of God is available, is open, is welcoming. It's not just that God is near and God is at work and God is demonstrating that he rules over things and that God is making all things new. It's not just that, but it's that it's there for us. It's open for us. The kingdom of God is near. The kingdom of God is available. How blessed, the Sermon on the Mount begins with, how blessed are you who mourn, for you will be comforted. Why? Because the kingdom is here. How blessed are you? Because God is present. And this kingdom is a place, it's a reality, that God's authority over all of the earth is unrivaled. God has no rivals. There is not an epic battle for our souls or for the state of the earth. It's already been solved. There is God and there is creation. There's God and there are creatures. In the midst of our chaos and our darkness, a light shines. A realm exists where God's authority, where God's life, where God's power reigns. This is a place where human beings can live whole and healthy lives, where our bodies will be restored, where our community will thrive, where justice will roll down. You see, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. And God has not abandoned the earth, but has started as small as a mustard seed in the life of one person, Jesus of Nazareth, and demonstrated his authority and his power and his reign. And so we can start from this moment, this moment of Jesus demonstrating his authority, and now we can look backwards and work backwards. And look at each of these moments of healing was not this constant conquest, but a demonstration or an unveiling, a revealing of what actually is, of what God's future holds. You see, sin and alienation and destruction and chaos do not and will not have the final word. That which threatens us has an expiry date. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it. And Jesus entrusted himself to that and demonstrated that. And so we can be like the centurion and we can come to Jesus with whatever it is that ails us and entrust ourselves to his reign. You see, the centurion, why he's our example of faith is because he knew that it all was God's anyway. Jesus, you don't need to come into my house to heal my servant. You have authority over it all already anyway. God has authority over it all already anyway. He entrusted himself to the reign of God. We can be like the leper that comes to Jesus and asks to be cleansed and to be touched. We can bring our vulnerabilities and our fears. In the midst of the storm, we don't have to be afraid that if we stop fighting, it's all for naught. We don't have to be afraid of our limitations or our vulnerabilities. Because it doesn't depend on us anyway. All throughout the scriptures, the practice of Sabbath is a practice of our limits. It's a way in which we remember that we have to rest. We are not action heroes. None of us are. But it's not just a practice of our limits. It's a practice of our limits in light of the fact that God has no limits. It's a way of remembering again our place in this ecology, this economy of God at work in the world. That when we rest, God doesn't. Every night when we go to sleep, it's another way of us practicing our limits. That when we sleep, God doesn't. The world still spins. Miraculously, things still hold.